For this last lecture, I'm presenting two topics that are kind of not in order. And like, you know, now that if I give this course again, I would present them this one at the end of the discussion about dynamical systems, because this is like a more advanced dynamical system that has beautiful applications. And it's also the first, as you're going to see, it's like a beautiful application of understanding chaos. So the Lorentz model. So as I mentioned, this is a really oversimplified model for weather prediction. And in the end, it boiled down to like three equations for three basic parameters, which are related somehow to the convection intensity, the temperature difference, and the deviation of the temperature difference from linearity. And so that's what these three variables are accounted for on the left-hand side. And they're all coupled. And you see that each variable has a negative term in, on the right-hand side, which would correspond to exponential decay. But then there's a positive term, which is either linear or in one case, if there's a linear drive, and in this case, quadratic. So there's driving terms and there's dissipation terms. And then the question is, well, what is the behavior of the system? And first point about this is that in terms of just, so I'm repeating a little bit from last time. So basic properties, these are coupled equations. They're nonlinear, which is really important to have non-trivial behavior. And finally, they are three-dimensional because there's three variables. And as I mentioned last time, there is a fundamental difference between two-dimensional dynamical systems and three-dimensional, because in two dimensions, orbits are kind of constrained. And there's something called the Poincaré-Bendixson theorem that says that, you know, that says that if you have like flow into some volume of phase space, there's no way out. And so that plays a topological constraint on the nature of the orbits, so that in two dimensions, orbits or like trajectories in phase space can either be stable fixed points, unstable fixed points, saddle points, or spirals. But in three dimensions, one can get much more wondrous behavior, which is embodied in the Lorentz map itself. And so another feature that, and this is where I stumbled last time, and so I want to fix it today, is that these equations have the feature that they're dissipative. And what I mean by dissipative is that if I have some, you know, so I have my state space x, y, z. And if I prepare an ensemble of systems, each with its own initial condition, so here's a point in phase space. And so according to this map, this state is going to like go in some kind of trajectory, whatever it's going to be. We'll figure that out momentarily. So if I prepare then a region, if I prepare lots of systems, so this is an attempt to draw some kind of a finite volume region. So I prepare lots of different points in the state space. And each one of them goes on its own trajectory wherever it's going. And then I can ask, so if I take this ensemble of initial points and let it run forward in time, does the volume of this set of points grow or shrink or stay the same? And the crucial point is that because the system is dissipative, this volume is always shrinking. So another way of putting this is that we can call it volume shrinking. Okay, so let me show that. And so the idea here is that the way that we try and show its volume shrinking is that we say, let's imagine that we fill up this sphere or any kind of a volume, whatever it's going to be, with all these points. And then I can ask myself, like, what is the flow of points either into the sphere or out of the sphere? If the flow is inward everywhere and always inward, then it says that this sphere is going to shrink to nothing. And so what we want to do is apply, and I guess it's called Stokes' theorem, which says that if I focus on a little area element dA here, and I ask, what is the flow into this area? So the flow, you know, into dA. And so let me call this these three things. And so I will use a different notation that I did yesterday, which helped get me confused. Let me call the vector x dot y dot z dot. Let me call this whole thing u vector dot. So the flow into dA is just going to be u dot normal hat times dA. You know, so if there's some velocity, you know, this is like basically the fluid flux. If I can think of my points in phase space, think of it as a compressible fluid. And so the fluid is flowing the state space. And so the flow through this little infinitesimal area, so flow into dA in time dt will be something that looks like that. And so it says that the volume at time t plus dt, delta t. So let's say this has volume v. So at a little bit later time, this is equal to the volume at some earlier time, plus or minus the flow in or the flow out. You know, we have to figure out which way the flow is going. And so what is that flow? We just have to integrate over the surface of the sphere. We have to add up all of these little local flows. And so that's going to be plus the integral over the area, surface, area of surface. And so it's going to be u dot n hat dA times delta t. And so finally, we can now like take the limit as delta t goes to zero, bring this to the left-hand side, divide through by dv by dt, and get this equation, dv by dt, a differential equation, which is equal to the surface integral of u dot n hat dA, surface. And then I appeal to the divergence theorem from electrostatics, which says that the surface integral of u dot n is the same as the divergence of u over the volume of the surface. So this is just elementary electrostatics. And so this is now the volume integral of del dot u dv. And so all we have to do is now compute the divergence of this flow field. And so we have to compute, you know, d by dx of x dot, d by dy of y dot plus d by dz of z dot. So let's just do that. So del dot u is equal to du x by dx plus du y by dy plus du z by dz. And so u x is sigma x y minus x. So when I differentiate sigma y minus x, I'm going to get here minus sigma. The second term, I have to differentiate this guy with respect to y, and I only get minus 1. And then I differentiate the last guy with respect to z, and I'm going to get just minus b. So clearly, this is less than 0 because everything here is negative. So what this says is that if you prepare like an ensemble of phase-space points in some, you know, an ensemble of them that occupies some volume V, and then ask what happens to this volume as time goes on, this volume shrinks. And there's nothing that prevents this thing from shrinking to zero. So the crucial point is that as the system evolves in state space, it goes to a zero volume region of phase space. So that's the important conclusion from all of this, is that available phase space volume or state space volume shrinks to zero. So that's already one amazing feature about this, is that you know, the part of the phase space that you actually occupy as time goes on is an infinitesimal, it's a zero volume part of the phase space. And the only way you can achieve zero volume is you have to either be at fixed points, or you could be constricted to be on zero volume sets, which would be like flat planes or flat surfaces. So that's one important fact about this Lorentz map. All right. So next point is, let's look at the fixed points. You know, when we have like some dynamical system like this, you know, we saw in the case of two-dimensional dynamical systems that our program was to fall into null clines, and from the null clines find the fixed points, and from the fixed, and then at the fixed points we'd do like a local analysis, like what happens locally near a fixed point, and from that we would try to infer the global analysis. And in doing the local analysis, I basically did it by pictures. Oh, yeah, question.
Did you put any constraint on the velocities that the particle following these trajectories has?
I mean, the velocity is determined by the equations themselves.
I know, but are they necessarily finite, or within some region?
Because what do you mean the velocity?
Because what you proved is that the volume in your configuration space goes to zero, but you said available phase space volume shrinks to zero.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out why the volume in phase space, the momenta also goes to zero.
Momenta.
Because phase space is the kind of.
No, there's nothing. I mean, the thing is that the point is that, you know, I have my points in state space, they're shrinking to zero, but they could be zooming around infinitely quickly. There's no constraint on the actual speed that points are moving.
The volume of phase space isn't zero. The volume of configuration space is zero. Is that right?
Well, I'm sorry. I'm using configuration space and phase space the same thing. I mean, state space means a state x, y, z.
Oh.
And so these are points in state space. Okay, maybe I should put it here, state space.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I'm using phase space, state space interchangeably, sorry. Okay, anyway, so, you know, what we did in the two-dimensional case is we found the null clines, we found the fixed points, we did a local analysis about the fixed points, and from that we would infer the global behavior. And what we did in the case of two-dimensional maps is, because it was so simple, we would just sort of do it by pictures. But the proper way of doing a local stability analysis is that you would take your equation of motion, linearize it about the fixed point, in which case you get a linear set of equations, and you look for the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this linearized transformation, and that tells you if the eigenvalues are positive, it says that the flow is out. If the eigenvalues are negative, the flow is inward. If there's some directions where the flow is out and others where the flow is in, you'll get saddle points. So that's what we're going to do in the case of this three-dimensional map. The first step is, let's look for the fixed points. And it turns out there's only three fixed points in this map. One is trivial. Can someone see it right away, what one fixed point is?
Zero.
Yeah, very good. X equals Y equals Z equals zero. So that's one fixed point. That's the trivial fixed point. There's another set of fixed points, which I'll call, and I'm using notation of Ed Lorentz, which is, I'll call them C plus minus. And how do we find these fixed points? Well, first issue is that in order for a fixed point to exist, we must have x dot equals zero. And x dot equals zero means that x equals y. So at the fixed point, first of all, we have x star, whatever it's going to be, has to equal y star. So that's one sort of basic point. And now if I plug that into the second equation, so if I look at y dot equals zero, that gives me r x star minus x star, because x star equals y star, minus x star z is equal to zero. Yeah, okay. So anyways, so that says, and this is z star. So from this, I immediately get that z star is equal to r minus 1. So that was trivial. And now that we have that, we can plug it into the z equation, z dot equals 0. And so what we're going to get then is x star squared is equal to B times, oh, I'm sorry, this is 1 minus R. Got my sign right? That's fine, it's fine. X, R minus 1. So all, from all of this, we're going to find that the fixed point is given by x star is equal to plus or minus the square root of b r minus 1, and z star is equal to r minus 1. So those are the three fixed points of this Lorentz map. So again, the idea is now that we found the fixed points, and I'm saying these are the only fixed points. I mean, it's a little bit more work to show these are the only fixed points, but trust me that they're the only fixed points. Let's look at a local stability analysis. Let's first of all look at near the origin. So stability at 0, 0, 0. So formally, what we need to do then is we have to linearize these equations about the fixed point at the origin. So that is that I'm going to write x is equal to x star, which is 0, plus epsilon sub x. Y is equal to epsilon of y, and z is equal to epsilon of z, where these are now infinitesimally small because they're close to the origin. And we then write down the linearized equations for this. And so from this, I'll get epsilon x dot, epsilon y dot, epsilon z dot. And so when I linearize, I'm going to get here sigma epsilon y minus epsilon x. And for the second equation, I'll get r epsilon x minus epsilon y. But then there's a nonlinear term, and that I just dropped because it's nonlinear. And finally, we have xy, which is nonlinear, so we drop it, minus b epsilon z. Or I can write this as epsilon vector dot. And now this I can write as a matrix equation because it's a linear equation. And so I can write this as minus sigma 0 r minus 1 0 0 0 minus b times epsilon. And so to solve this equation of motion, then what we do is the usual thing. We try and diagonalize this transformation. And we have to look, first of all, at the eigenvalues and the eigenvectors. And so let me not belabor that because it's entirely straightforward. But it turns out that the eigenvalues, let me just write them down, are equal to the following thing. There is equal, so eigenvalues, there's minus b, and then there's 1/2 minus 1 minus sigma plus or minus 1 plus sigma squared minus, can't read my handwriting.
Yes, second order.
4 sigma r minus 1. So those are the eigenvalues. And it turns out, so there's two possibilities of, and from these eigenvalues, there's associated eigenvectors. But it turns out that there's two different regimes of behavior. First of all, if r is less than 1, so let's call these eigenvalues, you know, lambda 1 and lambda 2, 3. So for r less than 1, all lambda I are negative. So that says that our fixed point is stable. But in fact, it only says something very restricted. It says that the fixed point is locally stable. That is, if I'm infinitesimally close to the fixed point, then I'm drawn to the fixed point. So this is called locally stable. So let me erase this word and put the word locally in front of it. But in fact, for r less than 1, one can say a lot more. Because even though it's just locally stable, it turns out it's also globally stable. That is, no matter where you start in the phase space, you're sure to go to the origin if r is less than 1. So, in fact, 0.000 is globally stable. And so again, the definition of globally stable says that no matter where you start in the state space, so I'll try and be very careful to say the word state and not phase, wherever you start in the state space, you will always end up at the origin. So how do we show that? And it turns out there's a very beautiful way one can show that. So global stability. And the way one shows it is that one constructs a special type of function called the Lyapunov function, which you'll see it's sort of like an energy-like function. And what we're going to show is that this function, after I construct it, it will have negative time derivative, and it is a minimum at the fixed point. And so that's enough to show that no matter where you start in the state space, you always flow to the origin. So let me define this Lyapunov function, H. And I spent 5 minutes looking on YouTube videos of how to pronounce Lyapunov. And I think I sort of have the idea of what you're supposed to do. Anyways, so what is this function? So I'm going to say, let us define this function. So I'm defining it just kind of like, it sort of comes out of thin air. But the point is that if you do a lot of classical mechanics, I mean, there's Hamiltonian systems and there's like conservation laws, and one tries to look for conservation laws. And so from this equation of motion, it naturally suggests itself to define this following function: x squared over sigma plus y squared plus z squared. Let's just define this for fun. And the point is, first of all, you see it's a quadratic function of the coordinates. So it's certainly a minimum when z is equal to 0. So if I'm at the fixed point, this is certainly a minimum function. And what I want to now show that h dot is less than 0. So let's calculate h dot. So let's do that. So h dot. And in fact, to avoid annoying factors of 2, because I have quadratics here, I'm going to look at h dot over 2. So h dot over 2, that's equal to x dot over sigma plus y dot plus z dot. So x dot. So that's equal to, so I'm going to have y minus x times x, so that's xy minus x squared. The next term, yy dot. So it's rxy minus y squared minus xyz. And then plus zz dot, so I'm going to have plus xyz, we're in Canada, minus bz squared. So this and this cancel. And then I have minus x squared minus y squared plus xy. Oh, sorry, this doesn't cancel. This cancels that. So I have minus x squared minus y squared plus xy. And then I have plus rxy minus bz squared. But this stuff here, I can make this as minus x plus y all squared plus, so because I have minus, so I'll, sorry, I'm stumbling over my words here. What I want to put here is, when I do this, I have x plus y squared. Did I make a screw up with my sign somewhere? No, yes, I did. X dot. No, I didn't. Okay, I guess.
Okay, never mind.
Why? So there's minus two of this. So I have to. Why am I messed up here?
Do you want to write minus x minus y squared?
Yeah, I guess that's it. Thank you. Minus x minus y squared. And then this has a 2xy, and there's one xy here, so I've got to subtract an xy plus rxy minus bz squared. And so this I can write as minus x minus y squared minus bz squared. And then I have plus x, let me write it this way, minus xy r minus 1. So this is certainly negative. This is certainly negative. If r is less than 1, then this is negative. So this thing is less than 0 for r less than 1. So what this shows then is that this function h is a minimum at the fixed point. It's always decreasing with time. So that means that if I start at any point in state space, I see because of this h function that the h function is going to evolve in time. It's always decreasing in time. It's going to stop decreasing in time when I reach the fixed point. And so this says that any point in phase space is attracted to the origin, is a conclusion of this. All points. And again, I said it incorrectly. All points in state space. Flow to the origin. Okay. So now the question is, what happens if r is bigger than 1? And so when r is bigger than 1, I'll just put it over here because it's a little bit. So for r larger than 1, then it turns out that now two eigenvalues can you see that?
Yes.
Sort of. Two eigenvalues are bigger than less than 1, and 1 is bigger than 1. Did I get this right? I'm sorry. Less than 0, bigger than 0. So because there's one eigenvalue which is bigger than 0, it says that there is a direction in which this fixed point becomes unstable. So if I plot as a function of r the location of the stable fixed point, so my stable fixed point, so here is r equals 1. So my stable fixed point is at the origin. It's stable, stable, stable. And anywhere you flow into it. And then because of this change in the sign of the eigenvalues, there is what's called a Hopf bifurcation, where this fixed point becomes unstable. So I'm drawing this as unstable. I mean, the origin is always a fixed point, but it's an unstable fixed point. And being born out of this fixed point are two additional fixed points, which are these guys over here. And so the dotted line means to say that these are saddle points, so that they're stable in one direction, unstable in another direction. And so once I go beyond r equals 1, I have this instability happen. So that's locally what happens at the origin. Okay, but this is only part of the problem, or part of the story. So now we need to look at what happens.
What is the y-axis there?
Y-axis. This is just the, so this is, I guess what I'm plotting here is a z star, the value of the fixed point. You know, I could have plotted x star or z star. It doesn't really matter. Okay. So now we have to look at c plus minus, these other fixed points. So here, it's a little bit more involved, and I'm going to just sort of sketch what's happening rather than like.
Wait, sorry, Sid, would you mind repeating what you said? I was writing the other stuff down about the two eigenvalues less than 0 and 1 greater than something.
Right. So that says that if you're doing a localized analysis and you look, you know, you have a three-dimensional state space where the eigenvectors associated with the negative eigenvalues. So there's two such directions. And so in those two directions, flow is inward. And where you have the positive eigenvalue, that means that in that direction, the flow is outward. So it means that you're converging in two directions, but you're diverging in a third direction, which is a sign of a saddle point type of fixed point.
You're saying those eigenvalues up there?
Yes, exactly.
Which one's greater than zero?
I don't know off the top of my head, but I mean... Yeah, so the thing is that minus b is always negative. So that's always negative. The point is that then in the square root, when r becomes bigger than 1, the second term in that discriminant there is such that it dominates, such that one eigenvalue becomes positive and one becomes negative. So with the minus sign, it stays negative. With the positive sign, it becomes positive.
I don't quite understand the graph, though. How does z star relate to, like, the flow?
No, it has nothing to do with flow. I'm just saying that, you know, we found the fixed points. And so I'm just plotting the fixed point values. And the issue is that here, the fixed points are, you know, there are no more stable fixed points beyond r equals 1. They're saddle points, but they're not stable fixed points.
Okay. Is that like a plot of the eigenvalue? Because it's like a square root, or no. How'd you get the plot for z star?
How did I get the what?
I think
I'm sorry. I should have written here. I guess what I should have written here is x star. Because there's two, you know. Sorry.
Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
Okay. All right. So, anyways, at this other fixed point. So again, just following before, we would do a linearized analysis. So, linear stability analysis means that I would write like x is equal to x star plus epsilon x, y is equal to y star plus epsilon y, and z is equal to z star plus epsilon z, where now x star, y star, z star are not zero, but they're these fixed point values. And then you plug these into the equations of motion, and then one just linearizes the result. And what one gets at the end of all of this is epsilon vector dot. So, you know, I'm not deriving it. I'm just telling what the result is. Is equal to this following matrix.
Y is y equal to y star plus epsilon z and...
Ah, god dang it. How did I do that? That really seems dyslexic, doesn't it? Yeah, I don't get that. Anyway, so it's minus sigma zero. R minus z star minus 1 x star minus b epsilon. And so what happens here is it turns out that So again, there is like, you know, from this, you would then compute the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this matrix. So there's going to again be, you know, three eigenvalues. And the main point here is, and so let me maybe go back to this plot. Let me make this a little bit shorter so I have room for what I want to show here. There's a second instability here. R sub h. Where these fixed points, I said something incorrect, that there's only three fixed points. There's actually an additional set of fixed points. The point is that this instability where a stable fixed point becomes unstable and it gives birth to two additional unstable fixed points, this is called a Hopf bifurcation. Beyond RH, it turns out that there's these fixed points. I'm saying something incorrect, and I'm not quite sure where I'm going here. So just bear with me a moment. Hang on a second. What am I doing wrong here? I'm saying something manifestly stupid, and I'm just not sure what it is. Yeah, I guess the point is that in this range between 0 and 1, this is a fixed point that is like it's a saddle point. Beyond this point R sub h, this becomes completely unstable. So maybe I draw it like this. Where here, this means saddle point. And here, this means unstable. But in addition to that, there's additional unstable fixed points that do something like this. So this is a little bit more involved, and I'm not going to do the analysis of this, but just to give you a sense that there is this first bifurcation, which is called the Hopf bifurcation. Sometimes it goes by the word pitchfork bifurcation because that's what it kind of looks like, a pitchfork. And then there is a sort of this inverted pitchfork bifurcations here, where this saddle point becomes an unstable fixed point. And so I guess that's the only thing I just wanted to say beyond for this is that for R greater than RH, C plus minus is unstable in all directions.
Sorry, I'm very confused. Can you explain the thing after R bigger than RH again?
Yes. So the point is that for R between 1 and R sub h, those fixed points, there's a minus b, and then there is, I have to admit, I'm a little bit shaking myself about what I want to say. So ask your question again, and then let me.
Yeah. What is RH?
RH is the point at which
all eigenvalues are positive.
Yes. So R greater than RH, all lambda I are greater than zero.
Okay. But not those. They come from this.
That's right. Because this is at the origin. But this is now the value of the eigenvalues along this fixed point. And so beyond here, they're all positive. And so it means that we have this situation which sort of doesn't make any sense. All the fixed points are unstable. I mean, the fixed points C plus minus are unstable. So that means if you are near that fixed point, you're going to flow away from it. But this whole map is volume contracting. So how do you have volume contraction, and yet when you get close to the fixed point, you're driven away from it? And that's the amazing feature about this Lorentz map. It has this sort of paradoxical feature that volume contracts so that you're living on like flat surfaces in the three-dimensional space. And if you get anywhere close to this fixed point, you're driven away from it.
Wait, I'm sorry, I'm a little confused, because I feel like if the volume's contracting, then shouldn't the points be going away from the fixed point so they're not, like, increasing the volume there?
No. I mean, normally you'd say that, like, volume contraction would be consistent with, like, a stable fixed point. If you have a stable fixed point, the volume would contract. But here, the volume is contracting, but the fixed points are unstable. That's the amazing feature about this.
What's the difference between, we were talking about the volume shrinking to zero and that being.
So the thing is that near the origin, we have this feature that there's this Lyapunov function, which has a negative time derivative and has a minimum at the origin. So it says that for r less than one, all points will flow to that fixed point. Mm-hmm. So that makes perfect sense because we had volume contraction, we have a negative Lyapunov function, and so we just contract until we get the origin. But once I get beyond R equals 1, then one of these eigenvalues becomes positive. And so now there's something paradoxical going on because I'm saying, well, there's volume contraction, but like when I get close to the fixed point, there's a direction where I'm flowing away from it.
But that all depends on our initial like R and.
Yes, absolutely. So that, I mean, so the point here is remember what the value, what R was supposed to signify. That was meant to be the Rayleigh number, which is like the external driving. It's like how sunny is it out that day? And like what is the, and that drives the temperature difference. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you increase the Rayleigh number, you're driving the system harder. And so you have this change in behavior. Like when the, when there's not much driving, then you just go to this quiescent state where there's no temperature gradient. I mean, where the temperature gradient is purely linear and there's no convective flow. But as you increase the Rayleigh number beyond a critical value, then, you know, kaboom, something weird is going on where there's still volume contraction, but unstable fixed points. And so the amazing feature about this that I'm actually going to show, we're going to have a break. I'm going to show movies after this, which I'm going to show the flows in the state space because they're just so amazing. Okay. Yes.
At the origin, the B direction is always the flows going into the origin.
Say that again?
At the origin.
Right.
Z direction, it always goes into the origin. So probably all the flows can go into the
origin. At the origin, yeah. There's what? Well, no, there's certainly no contradiction, but
yeah,
I'm not sure I'm not understanding your point though.
So, I mean, there's still some ways that all flows go into the
So your point is,
even if R is greater than RH.
Yeah, so I guess the point is that near the origin, no matter what the value of RH, there's always one negative eigenvalue. So there's one direction where you're going in, but the other two directions could, you know, one direction turns out to be positive, one is negative. So I'm not sure what the point though is. The fact that there is one positive direction means that if you, unless you come into the fixed point in exactly that, you know, right direction, then there will be a point as you get close to the fixed point that you'll be driven away from it because there's a positive direction. So the fact that there's positive eigenvalues is what makes this a little bit weird. And in fact, again, beyond RH, when there's no, when the fixed point C plus minus are unstable in all directions, and how do you, you know, how do you reconcile, you know, shrinking a volume of state space and unstable fixed points? So I guess maybe this is a good place to stop, because what I'm going to do is show home movies of like the flows in state space after we take a quick break. Yes.
What did you mean by saddle point? There's a direction that goes
saddle point. Saddle point means that I have a fixed point in which at least one direction is unstable and another direction is unstable.
So R equal to RH is a saddle point in this?
No. So for R less than RH, the fixed points are these fixed points are saddle points for R less than RH. Beyond this point, they're unstable fixed points.
Where are the other lines on?
These are two additional fixed points. So I said something wrong at the very beginning. That's only three fixed points. There's two additional fixed points, and they merge at the saddle point. And so this feature where you, if you go in this direction, that like this unstable fixed point becomes a saddle point and gives birth to additional fixed points, that's what's called a subcritical Hopf bifurcation. So that's a technical term, but
when you increase your R from big R, you have an additional
Right. I didn't, and so that was erroneous what I said at the very beginning.
But if you set the equations equal to zero, and if you want to extract fixed points, the only fixed points that you will get are those two. What is the process of deriving the?
Yeah. You know what, like, unfortunately, I'm going to have to punt on that because I don't know it off the top of my head how to do it. But, I mean, again, you asked the right question, the good question. I'm not sure I know how to answer it. So if you're listening in the back, you can bring down the screen. Thank you. Well, so now you're asking about something which is called recurrence. Like if you are, and the other point is that if you come back to the same point, because it's a first order system, if you come back to a point, that means you're going to come back to it again and again in the orbit, which means it's inconsistent with volume shrinking. So you cannot have a closed loop when you have volume shrinking flows.
Okay. Can you get infinitesimally close to it?
Yeah, you could be infinitesimally close, but it means no matter what, you're going to get closer, you're going to get shrink further and further. So each time you come around the orbit, you got to be moving like into a smaller and smaller region of state space. So this feature that it's a dissipative map is actually an extremely strong statement, because it says something globally. You cannot have, that the only thing you can possibly have are stable fixed points, or saddle points, because if you had and I realize I'm saying some things here that are inconsistent with what I've written down, so I'm sorry that I'm messing this up on the very last lecture where I can't correct myself in the next lecture. So the point is that if you have a volume shrinking map, each fixed point can either be stable because that's consistent, or it could be a saddle point because you have to have some directions going in that overwhelms the directions going out. If you had a purely unstable fixed point, well, then that means locally you're flowing away from that, which is not consistent with volume shrinking. So volume shrinking means that you can only have saddle points or stable fixed points and nothing else.
Oh, so the fixed points here were saddle points?
Yes, they're all set. Yeah, okay. So I'm...
So is there still the negative B eigenvalue?
Yeah, I didn't. No. The negative B was for that case, for the case of the other fixed point.
Yeah, so the thing is that we have to, well, so now it's behind the screen, but there's like, you know, we have to look at the eigenvalues of this matrix and see what they are. But again, you'll have, there'll be saddle points in the sense that there'll be an eigenvalue which is positive.
So they would go back to they would go in some direction that is inflowing into the fixed point, and therefore they would go there and stay.
Well, but the thing is that if you choose your initial condition just right, you know, then you can be on a part of, you know, the part of the orbit which actually flows, you know, exactly into the fixed point along this stable direction. But that means you've got to get every single decimal place correct.
Okay, so I should probably ask questions after you show the video, because it's it gives more intuition.
Yeah, okay.
I have a question. It's like x times y is always positive, because
x times y.
Because when we show the derivative of left node function.
No, but x times y doesn't have to be positive. Wait a second. Let me think about that. At the fixed point, we know, well, first of all, at the fixed point, x equals y. So at fixed points, that's true, but not any outside the fixed points.
So when we show that the derivative of Laplace function is negative, we assume like x times y is positive.
No, I didn't assume anything about that, because this is for any point in the state space. So here is the Lyapunov function.
Yeah, but the final equation.
No, but the final equation, you know, which is now is hidden behind here, but the point is that it didn't assume x equals y.
The third term is xy times 1 minus r.
Right.
So to make it negative, we should assume that xy is negative. Because.
Okay, good point.
No, I think because there's like a 2xy. In the
what was hidden behind the board, it's x minus y,
and I think there's like
squared
you'd have
minus bz squared minus xy r minus 1.
In that x minus y squared.
What he's objecting to, and which I don't have an answer for right now, is that, well, if x and y are equal, then yes, this is negative for r less than 1, but you know, what if this product is negative? And so I don't have an answer for that right now.
No, but I think it's like related to the x y term and the x minus y squared bit. I think maybe there's.
Did I make a mistake?
You got the minus x minus y all squared.
Yes.
And so you could write that out and maybe compare the two terms, and maybe part of it's just always going to be greater than the other part.
No, but you can drive all.
Yeah.
This is, I have to say, I'm feeling really badly that I'm making such a mess out of the very last lecture here. Say it again? No, so I have to say, like, this, you know, you've raised a good point. I'm not sure I know the answer. What can I say about this? No.
Was there a condition that R was less than 1?
Yeah, what I wanted to say here is that if R is less than 1, if this product is positive, this whole thing is necessarily negative. So the point was that the Lyapunov function is less than, its time derivative is less than 0 when R was less than 1 for all points in state space. And so what you've pointed out is like, maybe there's a way out of this. And so I'm sure that this is correct, that the Lyapunov function has a negative time derivative, but I don't know how to answer your question. So you're asking great questions. And you know, stumping me—that's a good sign. So let me let me stop this. I want to. So, anyways, what I want to show to just give you some intuition for this is some home movies of what happens with the Lorentz map. So here are the fixed point values. So here are the fixed point values, and so I'm interested in the case R beyond R sub h, and so first. Let's look at the actual orbits themselves. So I'm going to plot. So there's two ways we could think about this. We could plot as a function of time x of t, y of t, z of t. So that's one way we plot things. Or we could plot parametrically. We could plot as, you know, if we have this orbit in state space, we could look at x as a function of z. And so there's two ways of doing it, parametrically or as a function of time. And it turns out if you do them together, you learn something interesting. And so, you know, by the way, if you're wondering like where this is coming from, so the question is, can we extract a pattern from aperiodic trajectory? And I don't know if you can hear, there's a voice in the background, that's me. So this is actually a course that's 4 years old that still hasn't been published for reasons having to do with COVID. But anyways, the idea here is, can we extract a pattern from the aperiodic trajectory? So what I'm plotting now, so there's two things we can plot. Z is a function of t, or z is a function of y. And so these are the two fixed points, c plus, c minus. So here is a typical orbit. And this is like this feature of like zooming from one around one fixed point and going to the other in an apparently chaotic pattern. And so you see z as a function of t is doing oscillatory behavior as a function of time, but really kind of with strange, you know, with changes in the amplitude, and that corresponds to the switching in the state space. So so the issue here is like, can we learn something, can we find something systematic out of this apparently weird behavior where if I start near a fixed point, I'm spiraling out and I go for a while and then all of a sudden I jump where I'm spiraling around the other fixed point, and then I spiral back to the other fixed point. So I'm jumping between the two fixed points. And this feature of jumping between two fixed points, this is one of the most amazing features about fluid mechanics. So if you want to know another unsolved problem for which if you could solve, you can book your ticket to Stockholm in advance, is how do you understand aperiodic behavior from a steadily forced system? And so I'll tell you personal experience because, you know, it happens to me all the time and it always bugs the hell out of me, which is that some of you know now that I go to the gym all the time. And so when I'm on the gym, there's a gym in my apartment building, and there's an exercise bike, there's a big box fan. And so because I, you know, you get really hot if you're biking hard, you know, put the box fan right on me. So I have myself riding my bike, I have the box fan on me, and it's blowing air on me. And so it's blowing air, and it'll blow for like 30 seconds, and then all of a sudden I feel 10 seconds of nothing. And then it goes back, and then I feel like, you know, a steady flow, and then it goes away for a while, and then it comes back for a while. And the point is that if you could actually visualize the airflow in that system, you would see that there would be steady flow for a while, but then there'd be an oscillation, and the flow would sort of go to my right or to the left, and then it hits me again. And so how do you develop non-steady flow from steady forcing? And that's still not really understood in a natural way. And then beautiful example of this is something called the von Karman vortex street. Have people heard of this? Maybe seen pictures of this where you have like a body where you have flow going past a body and you want to visualize the flow. And so you think, well, the flow is going around the body and it goes like this and it does that. But the wake behind develops all kinds of oscillatory behaviors. And that's called the von Karman vortex street. And that's one of the most beautiful phenomena in all of fluid mechanics. And so this is kind of in the same way that, you know, you're flowing around one fixed point doing kind of a, you know, some kind of a spiral, but then at some point you jump and spiral over here. And so this is sometimes called the butterfly map because it looks like the two wings of a butterfly. And that's, so now the thing is that what can we extract from this butterfly? And so let's see what we can extract. So what Lorentz, okay, well, so let's see what I had to say about this. Yeah, so the point here is that we're trying to understand like how we switch from one side to the other. And the point is that, you know, there was this Z as a function of T, and that you depart from one spiral when the value of Z exceeds some threshold value, which is pretty much fixed. So this is just an empirical observation. And the point is that once you go from one spiral to the other, where you're injected onto the other side determines how long it takes before you get to the maximum threshold again, which then determines how long you spend on the other side. So the time between switches is somehow governed by like when you join or when you enter another spiral. And so I'm going to show another plot momentarily that tries to illustrate this. And I'll slow it down because it goes by a little bit too fast. So I don't know if you can hear me.
In some sense, determines maximum Z X cycle. And so as a numerical experiment, one can't solve this analytically. As a numerical experiment, one can plot Cn plus 1 maximum of the amplitude of Z on one.
So each of those green points, you can say like, you know, here is the maximum at one cycle, the maximum the next one, so there's Z0, Z1, and so on down the road. And what Lorentz, which is brilliant analysis, did is said, let me plot Zn as a function of Zn minus 1, and let's see what that does. So, you know, you can see here that it looks like Z1 is increasing as, you know, Z1 is bigger than Z0, Z2 is bigger than Z1, so it looks like it's increasing, but then it decreases, it increases, and then it increases a lot, decreases a lot. So there's some kind of a map that tells us the behavior of Zn plus 1 is a function of Zn, and the question is that a simple map, a complicated map? And it turns out that it's pretty simple. So I take a value of Z0, I find a Z1 which is bigger, I go back to the 45 degree line to find the new Z1 to then figure out what Z2 is. And so these green points are like the map of Zn plus 1 as a function of Zn minus 1. And you just do this over and over again. And so now we're just doing this really quickly.
But the crucial point of this function is that everywhere you see that the slope of this function, at the absolute value of the slope, is everywhere greater than 1, because it always implies an increasing part implies both the modified new one and the decreasing part implies the increasing part of the increasing part. So this allowed Lorentz to then make some predictive statement about Cn plus 1. So this map is called the Lorentz map. And the crucial feature is that from this Lorentz map, one can extract order of fields. So this is one of the only ways that we could so far trying to extract something simple and low dimensional with a very periodic order.
What?
Right? No, there's an interesting problem. Okay. Look at that.
What?
Order from chaos. I think that's something that he says all the time.
Okay, I guess that's all I have to say about this, Lorentz. So you can raise the screen, please. So I mean, this is just a little taste of like something of some of the amazing features that happen for the Lorentz map. And you know, this was like a watershed in the whole field of nonlinear dynamics because it was a fairly thorough analysis of a three-dimensional dynamical system. And it was the feature that you have volume shrinking, but no stable fixed points. And so trying to characterize the flow in the state space. And it's really quite beautiful. Yes?
Is there a method to come up with the Lyapunov function, or is it like?
It's sort of extemporaneous. Every single system involves its own analysis. So, yeah. So it's just cleverness to figure out what it is.
Is it unique, or is it like any function with like h dot with the sum zero would be the same for us?
Well, I mean, the point is you want to invent a function such that h dot will be negative throughout the entire evolution.
Any function that's fine this could be used. Any function that's fine this could be used in this analysis.
Yeah, but it's sort of like the same as, say, like the Runge lens vector in classical mechanics. I mean, you know, one has to think of just the right thing that is conserved, and in this case, or is dissipating. Okay, so in the remaining like 20 odd minutes, when I was talking about random walks, I mentioned about how there's you have the master equation for one-dimensional diffusion, and from that you get a Gaussian probability distribution. And so what I just want to mention now is like something which maybe some of you have heard about. It's the central limit theorem. And the central limit theorem is an incredibly powerful and beautiful theorem. And what it says is that if you have any kind of a hopping process in which the single-step hopping probability is what are called IID variables, identical independently distributed random variables, such that the mean value and the mean square value of the single step hopping rate is less than infinity, and that's it, then you're guaranteed that in the long time limit, your distribution of displacements will be a Gaussian. So this is called the central limit theorem. And so I guess what I want to do in the remaining time is to try and argue it for like some special case, but it's sufficiently general that it has the main idea for any case under the sun. So the central limit theorem is the following. So given a single step hopping probability so let's call it p of x. So what I mean by that is I have on the one-dimensional line, I'm at a point x here. Oh no, so I'm at some point. And so there is probability of hopping a distance x. So x is the distance that I hop. There's some p of x. And the conditions that I need from this is the following. With p of x for every single step, so it's the same. So p of x is what's called an IID variable. IID variable. people heard the terminology IID? Okay. So, pardon me? No, no, P of X is the IID variable. So this is independent, identically distributed. So that means that every single step, you have no memory of the process, and you're doing the same thing at every single step. You have this probability distribution of how far you step. Every time you step, you consult your probability distribution, and you choose your next step according to this probability distribution. And one more thing is that I'm going to assume that X average is equal to zero. So I'm assuming that it's symmetric. I don't need to choose it's symmetric. It's just that for the sake of simplicity to finish this in the next few minutes, I'll talk about the case of the symmetric case. But as an exercise, once you see what I'm going to do for the symmetric case, it's easy to generalize it for the non-symmetric case. So X average, the average, so it's symmetric. And then here's the only thing which is non-trivial. The mean square distance that you hop is less than infinity. And in fact, let me call this thing here. Let's define this thing to be sigma squared, less than infinity. If given this condition, then Pn of x, which is the probability distribution after n steps of the random walk, is going to be a Gaussian. And so this has nothing, so it doesn't matter what P of X is. It could be uniform distribution, triangular distribution. You could step, you know, like a million, you know, you could go a distance a million miles this way and 2 million miles this way with, you know, you go 2 million miles this way with 1/3 of the time and 1 million miles this way, 1/3 of the time. You know, whatever it is, as long as it's symmetric, and again, this symmetric is actually not crucial because I could choose asymmetric, and then it just turns out that the Gaussian is with respect to the average position. But for simplicity, I'm talking about symmetric here, and the mean square is finite, then you get a Gaussian. And this is also an example of a renormalization type problem in the sense that, as you're going to see, one looks in momentum space at the small k behavior, and that's the thing which dominates, and you don't worry about larger k behavior. And in fact, what we do is you just throw it away, and that's good enough. So let's do this. So first of all, to start, we need to write down the evolution equation for Pn of x. So given that I'm at a given point in space after n minus 1 steps, how do I get to position x? So there's something here called the Chapman-Kolmogorov equation that tells me how this you go from a point x prime after n minus 1 steps to x. So this is going to be, I take n minus 1 steps, I'm at x prime. And then to get to position x, I have to hop a distance x minus x prime. And if I'm hopping a distance x minus x prime in a single step, it's according to this probability distribution. So here we have p of x minus x prime. And if I integrate over all possible x prime, the x prime, that tells me what is the probability that I'm at position x at the nth step. I'm at some other position, x prime, at the n minus first step, and I took a hop of a distance x minus x prime. And I have to sum up over all possible values of x prime. So this thing is called the Chapman-Kolmogorov equation, in case you want to see it in a textbook. Chapman-Kolmogorov. Okay. So the thing is that if we can compute, so what we want to do is compute Pn of x. And so now what we're going to do this is let's introduce the Fourier transform. Let's get this guy out of the way. Let's introduce the Fourier transform. So let me define P of k is equal to the integral over all space dx, P of x, e to the I kx. And then also Pn of k is equal to the integral over all space dx, Pn of x, e to the ikx. And the crucial point is that this equation has a structure of what's known as a convolution, because the sum of these two arguments adds up to x. And because it's a convolution, when we take the Fourier transform, it turns into a simple product that we can easily deal with. So let me take my original equation here. Let me multiply by e to the ikx and integrate over all space in x. And let's see what happens when we do that. So on the left-hand side, we just have the Fourier transform. So what we're going to get on is on the left-hand side, we'll get Pn of k. Over here, what I can do with this guy is I can write it in the following way. I can write it as e to the ikx prime, e to the ikx minus x prime. We can do that without changing anything. But then the e to the ikx prime will go with this guy, and I'm integrating over x prime, and that gives me the Fourier transform of Pn minus 1. And the e to the ikx minus x prime goes with this guy, and I'm integrating over x, and then that gives me the Fourier transform of this guy. And so this is nothing more than Pn minus 1 of k, p of k. So for convolution in real space turns into a product in Fourier space. And so then that says, well, now Pn minus 1, that's Pn minus 2 times p squared, Pn minus 3 times p cubed. And so we go all the way down to p 0 of k, little p of k to the power n. And so the last thing to finish this is we have to ask, what is the Fourier transform of the probability distribution after zero steps? And so again, let me choose the simple initial condition that particle starts at the origin. So if a particle starts at the origin, then its Fourier transform, if this is a delta function at the origin, I'll just get 1. So this just goes to pkn. So that's all there is to it. So now we have to, well, so now what is pk? So pk was this guy, and so what is this? So this is integral over all space. So the point here is that what it's going to turn out to be important is we need to look at the behavior of this object for large x. And that's going to turn out to be involving the behavior of this guy for small k. So let's do a power series expansion of this guy. So this I can write as dx, p of x, and then I have 1 plus ikx minus k squared x squared over 2, and then I'll have plus or minus ik3x3 over 3 factorial plus dot, dot, dot. And so what is the first term is dx p of x integrated over all x. This is the integration of the probability distribution of taking a single step over all space. And so that's 1 because I have to hop somewhere. So this guy, the first term is 1. If I choose here, I have dx x p of x, which is the mean position that I hop. And by assumption, that was equal to 0. So that term goes away. And again, if it's not symmetrical, you can actually work everything out line by line and work out what happens if it's not symmetrical. So the first non-zero term here is minus k squared over 2 and x squared p of x dx. That's the mean square hopping distance, which I define to be sigma squared. Then I have plus order k cubed. And what I'm just simply going to do is drop higher order terms. And again, if you want to be more careful, you can include the higher order terms and see what they do, but they are asymptotically irrelevant. So now we're almost at the end, because now we want to compute Pn of k. So that's equal to P of k to the power n. N, not squared. And so this is going to be approximately equal to 1 minus k squared sigma squared over 2 plus dot, dot, dot that I'm ignoring to the power n. And so this I'm going to write asymptotically in the limit as k is going to 0, This is the same as e to the minus n k squared sigma squared over 2. So again, in the limit where k is going to 0, and that's all I care about, which is the same as a large distance limit, we can do this, and it turns out that this is the kosher approximation as k goes to 0. And so finally, we now want to invert the Fourier transform, because now that we have the Fourier transform of the hop of the displacement distribution, now we want an inverse Fourier transform to find the thing in real space. So Pn of x, that's equal to 1 over 2 pi, the integral over all k values, e to the minus ikx minus n squared k squared sigma squared over 2. So we want to do this integral.
So how did you write Pn of k?
What do you mean?
How did you write n is equal to 1 minus k squared sigma squared?
No, sorry. It's... this equals this equals that. I'm talking about the single step hopping probability. This is another panel. This is another sheet of paper. So P of K is this thing. I do a power series expansion, and then I got this. So this bad blackboard technique again.
How did you get that?
So first of all, I expanded this into power series. What? Okay, so let's look at each term. So the first term is 1, x, p of x, that's just 1. Then the next term is x, dx, p of x times x, which is 0. The next term is x squared, p of x, which is defined to be...
how would you find the next, the x cubed one?
Well, I don't care, because the point is that, and again, I'm not showing it here, but I'm just saying that if you kept the next term, and went through the laborious calculation of keeping that higher order term, you would find that it is subdominant with respect to the dominant terms here.
Why should k be small there?
Because we're interested in the long time large distance limit. When n is large, right, x is large, which means that k is small. So there's always this inverse relationship between the transform variables and the real space variables. Okay, anyway. So in order to do this, so let me do the following. So I have 1 over 2 pi dk e to the, so let's write this, minus n squared k squared sigma squared over 2 minus ikx. And what I'm going to do now is basically complete the square and the exponential by adding and subtracting the same thing here. So let me do the following thing. Let me add plus x squared over 2n sigma squared, and let me subtract the same thing, x squared over 2n sigma squared. So I haven't done anything by doing that. And now the point is that all of this stuff here is a complete square. So this becomes 1 over 2 pi dk e to the what? And so I guess what I would say here is like there's a k, and then there's a square root of n squared sigma squared over 2. And then here I'm going to put a maybe I put the I over here. And then there's going to be x over square root of 2 n sigma squared, the whole thing squared. And do I want a minus? I want a minus sign here. So notice that if I square this thing, this guy, the square of this gives me this, the square of this gives me that, and this times this is going to give me exactly that. And so I'm left, and then I have minus x squared over 2 n sigma squared. So I finally have 1 over 2 pi e to the minus x squared divided by 2n sigma squared. And then I have left with the integral that I can write as dk. And now this is, since this is a constant, I mean, this is a constant with respect to k, so I don't have to worry about it. So I can write this as e to the minus, k squared a squared minus b dk. And this doesn't affect the value of the integral, so I don't have to worry about it. And so then the result of the Gaussian integral is just square root of 2 pi over a. And so the square root of 2 pi will make this a 1 over root 2 pi. And the a, 1 over a, is square root of n sigma squared. So this is 1 over root 2 pi. Let me raise this up a little bit. Oops. This is 1 over the square root of 2 pi sigma squared. 2 pi n sigma squared e to the minus x squared over 2 n sigma squared. So that is the final result, that the probability distribution is universal independent of the detailed form of the single step hopping probability, modulo that it has these two very simple restrictions. One is that the mean step is zero, symmetric, and that the mean square step length is not infinite. So you can choose any distribution you want. You'll still get this universal behavior in the large distance long time limit. And in fact, the issue of symmetry is not important, because if x average was not equal to zero, then what you would find, so let me just write down the answer. If x average is not equal to zero, then what you would get is that Pn of x equal to e to the minus x n x average n x average squared over 2n sigma squared divided by the square root of 2 pi n sigma squared, where now sigma squared is equal to x squared average minus x average squared. So if that's what that's a statement in the case of the unsymmetric case. So it's essentially all the same steps. It's just it's a little bit messier. Yes.
In the second board, you replaced Pn minus 1
dk
with
P naught. Tell me again. Top right corner. Yeah. Oh, sure. So let's just do this one more step. So this is the same as, so Pn minus, I just plug this back into this equation. So Pn minus 1 is Pn minus 2 times the factor of p. So this is p of k squared. And I just do this ad infinitum, and I get back to here.
Can you just again repeat what Pn and p, little p, are?
So little p is a single step hopping probability. Pn is the position distribution after n steps of the random walk.
Can you give the intuition for this Chapman equation?
Yeah, so I mean, let's see where. Say it again? Well, you could define it discretely, but the thing is that, you know, if you wait like a million steps of your random walk, I mean, the separation between different points is going to be so smooth that you might as well go to the continuous limit.
Yeah, no, I'm saying px minus x prime.
Yes.
X prime can have any value, can be as far away from x as
that's right. Yeah, so I mean, let me maybe answer your question, which maybe is going to help your question here, which is you're asking, you know, here I'm on the one-dimensional line, and I'm sitting here at position x after n steps. And so how do I get to n steps? So I could have been, you know, I start over here, maybe here's the origin. So I start here, I'm doing some hopping probabilities, I'm doing something like this, whatever it is. So here I am at n minus 1, I'm at position x prime. And now I have to hop all the way to here in the next step. So this is going to be governed by little p of x, is telling me. And so basically the Chapman-Kolmogorov equation is just saying that if I want to be at x at the end step, I had to be somewhere else at the previous step, and I have to hop in at one step all the way to x, and I have to just then sum up over all possible positions of this, of where I am at the previous step.
Is this Gaussian distribution only true because we are starting with this Chapman equation, or if we had some different kind of a master equation?
Well, this feature here of identically independent identically distributed variables plays a huge role, because what it's saying is that at every single step, the process starts over again. You have no memory of where you went in, and the process, you're doing the same thing. You're choosing the same step distribution every single time. So it's valid for independent steps, independent and identically distributed steps. Yeah, so that means that the Chapman-Kolmogorov equation precisely involves just the previous step, because, you know, everything previous to that has just been forgotten.
So it would be true for any random walk.
Yes, I mean, this is a statement true for any random walk of any kind, again, subject to these conditions.
I think you also completed the square wrong.
I completed the square wrong?
I'm not allowed to put the word behind this one.
Wait a second. See, I can hide my flaws by just saying, oh, it's behind the... Behind. Okay.
There's no I in the first term of the square, and there's a plus IX.
So you think what I should have done was make this IX?
And plus, and the I here.
Let's see if you're right. Okay, and there's a minus sign out in front. So this is minus K squared. K, so this is plus, and then the minus makes this a minus, thank you. And minus squared is minus 1. Thank you.
And also, I think in the first term, n is not squared, n is squared.
N sigma squared. Okay. Thank you guys for keeping me honest. All right. So now at least I didn't screw that one up too badly. Unless you have something else. Yeah. What? What should be squared? Oh, I see what my problem is. God dang it. Pn of k is this. God dang it. There's no squared here. No squared here. Oh, you can vault. Okay. I think now it's right. Sorry about that. Yes?
Also, like, why is this question telling us about scaling variables in some sense?
Well, I mean, thing is that, you know, the full distribution of single step hopping is, you know, it could be anything you want it to be. But the point is that what we're interested when we look at this Taylor series expansion, which is the very first non-vanishing term. So normally when you're doing a Taylor series expansion, you say, well, the first non-vanishing term is good when k is going to zero. And so that's why if I'm keeping only the first non-vanishing term, if it propagates to give me the final answer, all other information, which involves larger powers, higher terms in the power series, are ignored. And those are larger values of k, which correspond to smaller scale distance information that's being washed out. And so, you know, like normally we say, like in the normalization group, we're interested in large distance degrees of freedom. And so in the momentum space, we're interested in small k, and we integrate out large k. Here we're doing something even more drastic. We're just throwing it away.
So central limit theorem is true only for large scale
limit? Well, you know, again, the statement is that in the limit as n goes to infinity, the distribution goes to a Gaussian. And so if you want to ask, like, what are the corrections to the Gaussian, they will depend on lots of other things here. And one can actually compute, like, what is the corrections, the first corrections of the Gaussian, if you include the next order term in the single step hopping probability. And, you know, one can work that all out. But if one only is interested in the asymptotic behavior, which is often what we're only interested in, then you can be really sloppy and throw away all these other, you know, smaller distance scale degrees of freedom or large k degrees of freedom. Yes. If what? Yeah. Grows. So that means that, like, instead of saying you have IID variables, it's saying that the first step might hop this distance, the second step hops further, the third step hops even further still. Is that what you have in mind?
I think like X, the average value of X clear is on the
Well, so the first point is that if x squared average is not bounded, then the central limit theorem doesn't hold. And then you have different distributions for those sorts of processes, what are called, like, there's this thing called the Levy stable processes, where the mean squared displacement is infinite, not finite, and then the form of the distribution in that case is very different in character. But another thing you could imagine is, suppose that my mean square displacement after a single step is finite, but it's growing with time. And then it turns out that depending on how quickly it's growing, you can also do a central limit theorem for those types of processes. Pardon me? It's not really the birth, death, it's not really the birth, death process. It turns out that, for example, there's a process called Richardson diffusion, which was first discovered in the 1920s by a meteorologist named Richardson, the guy who did the quote about like the eddies inside of eddies onto viscosity. He would launch balloons into the air and look at the deviation of two balloons that were launched very close to each other, and found that instead of the distance growing as a square root of time, it grew as a time to the power 3/2. And that is called Richardson diffusion, where the diffusion coefficient is growing with time, which means that at every single step, the distance that you're going is even further and further. And so for that process, you can actually do an analog of a central limit theorem for that process. And, you know, it does work, but, you know, one has to work a bit harder. That's it.